Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 357. And I've switched up the order this week. I think I told you on the little bonus episode on Friday what this week's was going to be. But it's been changed at the last minute because I had the opportunity to have Auntie Donna on. Now, I'll tell the truth. I only found out who Auntie Donna are 2 weeks ago, if that. A week and a half ago, and they blew my mind. They've got a show on Netflix called Auntie Donna's Big Old House of Fun, and I'd seen some people post about it, say it was great, and I thought I'll give it a look, and I binged all the episodes in 24 hours and loved it. I recommend that you do the same, because we need more risk-taking shows like this. It's bonkers, basically. It's comedy. It's getting compared a lot to The Mighty Boosh, to Monty Python, but I honestly don't think it's... And also Flight of the Conchords, but I don't think it's like any of those things. It's very much its own weird and wonderful world. And yeah, I posted about it a bit, saying how much I rated it, and some of their long-term fans said you should get them on the podcast, and I said they'd be very welcome on the podcast. And they slid into my DMs, and we've now recorded a podcast, and it's out. You're listening to it now. So, yeah, I highly recommend the show. And as said, I think when places like Netflix or anywhere take risks on unusual stuff, I think it's so important to support it, particularly early, particularly that first week or two of release, because to be boring about it, that's how more risks get taken. I know I bang on about it with cinema all the time, that we need to support the great independent films that come out, because, to be frank, less and less are being made, because the blockbusters are where the money is, as cinema is, even before this, is starting to die out or lose its former glory, which breaks my heart. You all know I bang on about it all the time. I'm a huge fan of the cinema experience. Anyway, I'm going off on tangents. I need to tell you something. Speaking of people who like to watch stuff, if you like to watch stuff, one of the things that this pandemic has done is made me have to do all these podcasts over Zoom. And because that's happening, it means I've recorded all of them. So I decided over on patreon.com/scroobiuspip, which is $1 a month. You can pay more if you think it's worth more. I've decided to start uploading some of the videos. I'm going to be uploading 12 on the first 12 days of December. It's the 12 days of Pipmas. So yeah, if you fancy some of that, the hope is that you subscribe or join or whatever you call it, and then you just leave the resubscription on, and you know it costs you $1 a month. You don't notice it, but if loads of you do it, it really helps me and Buddy Peace and Jared and John, the people behind the podcast in its different areas, the people who need to get paid. But again, equally, if you don't want to, it's fine. There's no hard sell here. You will have heard, particularly at this time of year, I've got sponsors. I might have two, I might have three. It might get annoying. But again, it's how you get this podcast for free. And yeah, if you want to watch the videos, it's $1 essentially. Not $1 each video, $1 for the whole, for 12. So for like 15 hours. Yeah, that's all I need to tell you really. Go and watch Auntie Donna. Oh, I've launched some new merch recently. By the time this comes out, the fridge magnets of my head will probably have sold out, because I did another collaboration with Riker, who's the guy who did the He-Man toy version of me, the Star Wars toy version of me, and the kind of Action Man, old style big Action Man toy version of me. We wanted to do this little bonus collaboration at the end of the year that's more affordable, because all of the toys are expensive, because Riker is this amazing artist who charges thousands of pounds for a lot of his work and hand creates them. So we find a middle ground between my web store, which is always as cheap as I can realistically afford to make it at an independent level, and you know his quite understandable charging for his wonderful art. so we find a middle ground there. But with these, we wanted to go more down my end of the scale as a little thank you to everyone who supported. So yeah, they came out, they might have sold out, but the dope thing is we've also released these new sweaters with the slogan again, which kind of I think Arnie Donna will agree with, but the slogan of my label is "We may not be for you and that's fine." And we've slung that on some sweaters because it feels like a good year for it. So they're all at speechdevelopmentrecords.com. Little Christmas gifts for yourself or the ones you love if you feel... I mean, there's tons of stuff over there. There's vinyl, there's DVDs, there's records, there's gloves, hats, scarves, umbrellas, all sorts of jumpers and sweaters, beanies. The beanies are dope, actually. They're also the "We may not be for you and that's fine" beanies. So yeah, there's loads of good shit. Go and check it out. I'll leave it at that. I'll be back next week. Again, I might change things up again. I might, on that little bonus one I put out on Friday, I told you about a very exciting podcast I've recorded, but it might be next week. It might be the week after, because I'm flying by the seat of my pants at the moment, guys. And I've got some great guests potentially lined up, but they don't always happen. But when they do happen, they often have specific release dates that would help them out, as happened this week. So yeah, it's a long intro, isn't it? But it's a fucking good podcast, so you're going to enjoy this. This is Mark, Broden and Zachary, Arnie Donna. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. This piece of fiction is the intro to destruction. Well, should we get going? Is that good with you guys?
Yes, please.
Then we shall begin. Right, I'm joined today by Arnie Donners. I've got Mark, Broden and Zachary. How are you doing, gentlemen?
We're very good. Thank you so much for having us. You were very generous to us on Twitter. Someone said,
yes,
why don't you have them on the pod? And you were like, oh, I'd love to have them on the pod. And that's all we needed.
And we were like, then we're going to get on the pod.
we slipped into the DMs.
I genuinely get mad when people request people on the pods and don't tag them. It's like, tag them, man, so they can see that. So then we don't have to have any awkward kind of, yeah, oh, they don't want to come on. I don't want to approach them if they don't want to come on. I'll happily go, yes, this is cool. Let's talk publicly about this. And then, yeah, that's where we land.
We're very honoured to be here. We're very honoured.
I'm always excited when I have podcasters on the podcast because I know that it will just work, like tech-wise, sound-wise, talking-wise. It's generally the nerves with which I always send the bit, which I sent to you guys in your DM saying, look, can you have headphones on and can you record it? Because I won't name the exact ones, but I've had huge producers on who I've literally spent 15 minutes at the start of the Zoom as we're trying to figure out how to get the Zoom into headphones and then to record, even onto an iPhone. It was LP from Run the Jewels. He really struggled.
Joking? Really?
That's so funny.
That's amazing.
It was mad. He was outside as well. And I was like, man, it did work. It worked great. But it was like, you're an amazing producer and you're outside and you're just speaking on an iPhone at the moment, but we got there in the end.
Our podcast last week, we're running out of ideas. We're deep into the 2:30s. You know, we've done a lot. Our podcast is just comedy improvisation. And we're starting to learn there's only so many things in the world that are funny and are good ideas.
Yeah.
And we've done, so 10 episodes of our 2:30 have been good. But last week, we literally just took a Run the Jewels album, the instrumentals for the whole thing, and then just tried to rap over it. And none of us are rappers at all. And it's, you know, like there's some of it's in 3/4. And so, half of it was just us essentially giving each other times tables to try and solve on the spot in rhythm. So like beautiful. 5 times 5. And so
30.
So it's good to speak to one of our contemporaries is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So it must be tough on that front on doing a podcast that is kind of improvised and comedy improvisation every week. Because, again, as a podcast listener, you'll know that most podcasters repeat the same stories over and over again, and all sorts of things like you can't, like, I will, I guarantee at some point I'll mention that I'm an actor now and that I've worked with Tom Hardy. It comes up in literally every episode.
Wow. I would do that.
There's no way I wouldn't talk about that every episode of my podcast if that happened to me.
But my number one man crush for sure.
I mean, there's loads of podcasts I listen to, and a guest will lead onto a subject, and I'll be sitting there going, I know the story he's going to tell. So it must be tough to not have those things to fall back on, right? Because you've got to actually be original.
The joy of comedy is you can just say it's a running joke. I mean, there's a lot of British sketch comedian pioneers, I would say, that really paved the way. The way you can just do the same character saying the same things every episode, and people are like, yes, do it again. Yeah, and you're like, all right. You
know, like, it's this thing, like, we built this podcast kind of because when we were in like the development stage of writing new comedy, we had this area where we were just improvising out ideas, and some ideas would be really, really, really funny. But then when you try and convert them into a form that you could do regularly and repeatedly on stage, sometimes the magic died a little bit.
Yeah.
And you go, how do we capture that energy of just fun improvisation? And so the podcast became pretty much how we develop the content that you see on stage or on TV. And we have like a core fan base for the podcast, but there's some characters who are in our Netflix show now who are just characters from the podcast, like... that are based off maybe me. There's one time I mispronounced a word and said Moogie instead of like Boogie. And then Zach just made a character called Moogie, and he is now in the show. And it's purely just because of the stupid podcast. And like, even though a lot of our audience who watch the Netflix show haven't listened to the stupid podcast, the people who do are like so endeared because they're like, oh my God, this is from episode 182. You've turned this into a character on a Netflix series. So it's this weird fun thing now.
I mean, on these podcasts, I always go all over the place and off on tangents and around the timeline. But obviously there is something, you know, huge that has happened for you guys in recent weeks. So I think we need to start with that.
COVID.
You've got your own deal. You've got your own deal on Domino's.
Oh yes, there it is.
That's
beautiful setup.
My dream.
Knock that out of the park.
Genuinely, Tim. My dream. I think pizza is the best thing in the world. I don't know why people talk about sliced bread so much when there's far better things. So.
Took that dough and put tomato and cheese on it.
Yeah.
Can I just say, British Domino's, I think, is better than other Domino's. I don't know. I'd love your opinion on this too, but we've spent a fair bit of time in Scotland where they put corn on it. I'm not big on the corn, but I like the British Domino's.
I disagree. Like all things in Scotland, and I'm sorry if you have Scottish listeners, it's a little under-seasoned. But no, I respectfully disagree, Broden. I really want to go down this, like, which Domino's is the best part.
We can get into this for hours, because one of the big problems I have in America is American Pizza Hut isn't very good. And Pizza Hut's I think of it as America, but in the UK it's great. So the first time I had it out here, I was like, you've got like half the options. What's going on?
Do you know who has the best KFC?
Oh, see, now this is a place I'd like to talk from.
So, who's got the best KFC? This is legit. Britain
really
has really the best KFC. Yeah.
Well, this is contentious.
I genuinely
believe
that.
This is contentious, all right? Because I think everything in the American KFC is done better, with the exception of the fries. British KFC fries are great. British have great options. But if you've never had Australian KFC, you don't know what's up. I'll tell you that much now.
I think
Australian KFC is unbelievable.
So we have a thing in Australia called chicken salt, which is sort of a chicken flavored. It's almost like chicken stock powder meets salt, meets like some spices. It's got a very savory umami flavor. And our chips at our KFC have chicken salt on them. And I think that just puts us far and above away the wedges and the chips in the UK the US.
But at American KFC, you can get extra crispy chicken, and it's the best shit ever.
I mean, that's pretty impressive. Do you have gravy at KFC in Australia?
Yes,
the gravy
and it's the best.
Is a key ingredient.
However, there's this movement down here, Scroobs, that it's potato and gravy is the starting position. and the potato is not of a great quality.
It's
so,
a powdered potato. It's from, a reconstituted potato. Yeah.
Yeah, but, the, you know, we could talk about the differences in KFC around the world forever. And I would love to know from your audience their favorite KFC.
I feel like we've gone a little off topic here. It's understandable.
Not for me.
No, look, it's understandable, but I think we do need to get back to Domino's. So the thing about Domino's is... but no, that Domino's deal was very funny. And also something that came from the podcast as well.
Yeah, like, yeah.
That's the beauty of the podcast, I think, is that ideas that would have died in the rehearsal room or would have died in the writer's room get a bit of breath, get a bit of space to kind of become something and find its audience and then mutate into something bigger, which is, I think, a really cool thing. It's very, like, indicative of the world we live in now, that you can kind of just, like, throw things out and let people kind of give you the feedback straight away about whether it's something you want to keep keep cooking, I guess.
But this is something that happened recently with the Domino's deal. That I went on Domino's the other day because I was like, I'm going to get the Auntie Donna deal. Why not do myself a treat, right? Get a couple of Domino's pizzas, use the Auntie Donna deal, which is $31.95 for two pizzas of garlic bread and a 1.25 Pepsi product delivered to your door, $31.95. I get on the Domino's website and they've got a new deal for two pizzas of garlic bread and a 1.25 bottle of Pepsi product for $29.95. They were undercutting our own fucking deal. I only just saw this the other day, Pip. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know what to do. I got really mad. I screenshotted it and sent it to the boys. I'm like, what the fuck is this?
To be clear,
tell me you still went for your deal. Or did you?
Yes, I did. I paid more for it. I did. Right. I ended up paying fucking $35 because I got some extra shit on my pizza. Right. And I paid more for it as a point of reference. I was like, I'm not fucking letting them get away with this.
It's like when you hear about Jay-Z used to, on nights out, would only drink his own brand of whiskey and he'd pay for it because it was like, it's money in my own pocket. He's dunking on himself. He's like, that's going to come back in my residuals. This is all
so funny.
And we should make it very clear that the marketing department and the CEO of Domino's both tried to make it a better deal, but we're like, no, we have to stick with the funny here. Our manager as well, like every single person was like, you should try to make this like more affordable. And we're like, no, it's not funny if it's cheaper. If it's cheaper, there's this quality of it being a real deal. We want it to be exactly the cost of that deal.
I had a friend that paid $7 more for it because it was so much cheaper pickup to do it without the deal. And they went, no, give me the deal. And they ended up paying $7 more. That's the kind of fans we have.
I love it. It's a beautiful thing. Well, I mean, speaking of your fans, like one of the things, obviously, all jokes aside, you've just had a Netflix show and that's fucking amazing, right? That's mind-blowing. Yeah,
thank you.
Particularly as you say, from the way that things work these days of just doing things yourself, and it's kind of, you're doing it for the fun of doing it. You're doing a podcast, like, you know, YouTube stuff, all to work for stage stuff. For that to pay off in a Netflix show is amazing. But one of the things that I really enjoyed was the lack of gatekeeping in your fan base and the lack of snobbery. Often people who look like myself and Mark have that kind of hipster kind of, we were here first. Oh, you're all into Auntie Donna now. Oh, great. But there was none of that. There seemed like, as soon as I started posting about it, there were so many people like, I'm so glad you're into it. Look, here's some other stuff. Here's this stuff. Here's what was the first thing and all that. So, like, how's that been, seeing that reaction?
Oh, I think that was something it's something you try to cultivate. It's something you try to encourage. It's something you try to feed the positivity. You try to react to the positive comments, not the negative ones. You try to reward the positive posts, not the negative things.
Yeah.
And it's a very slow thing, and you hope that it works. You know, you hope that your fans are going to come along with you. You know, I think selfishly, for me at least, my biggest fear was that you sold out. You know, we have a thing in Australia called tall poppy syndrome. I don't know if that's what it's called in the UK. I'm sure it is in the UK. We're similar culturally like that. But my biggest worry was you guys sold out. You guys went to Netflix. And for us, it was always like, we always hope that our fans, our core fans that have been with us for 10 years, don't see it as us abandoning them. They see it as all of us getting this success. We all got this Netflix show. Yeah. Our weird little comedy style, we all got it. that was sort of always my thinking. And then I never really thought about the gatekeeping element until someone pointed it out. It was like, oh, that's also there. You know, there's when you breed positivity and when you have positive fans and when you just try to keep your comedy in a positive realm or at least away from negativity, you know, it's so good. It's so heartening and it's so nice to think, you know, it's so nice to think that exactly like you said, people that look like us aren't being douchebags about us. It's like, that's good. You know,
I think our fans have also known that we've been real poor for a long time and that this is like, this kind of shit allows us to just keep doing it, you know, like, cause there's only so long you can do YouTube comedy for before you either need to go, all right, we all need to go be teachers so we can fucking earn, you know, like earn a living and look after our families and shit. Not that any of us have little bubbies, but, who knows? Anyone got one on the way?
Not yet.
Not yet. Not yet. So like, they're not only supportive of the hardcore fans are not only supportive of the comedy, but they're very supportive of us as people and they just want us to be doing well and for Auntie Donna in general to be doing well. They're just the best, man. They're just the best.
They really are.
They give a shit about us, you know, not just about the work, but about us as people.
Did any of the kind of fear of the you sold out type thing? Cause again, I grew up into punk and rap and all, and they're all genres that as soon as you're successful, you're the absolute devil. You're shit now. It's kind of, it's a bizarre thing because you should want as many people as possible to hear something that you think is awesome. But did the fear of the you sold out thing come into your minds at all when you were working on the show and creating the show? Do you think it influenced you to stick to what you are and what you always have been?
There's two things I'd say on that. I think we're in the post you sold out era. Yeah. So there was the you sold out is the cool thing. And now I feel like people are in the, it's losery to say that now. It's losery to say you sold out. You're
completely.
In the, there are some people who are clever with what they say and like, but they're trying to be, you know, the alternative take people, but it's a very small minority. But, I think like what often happens in our sort of area where we're doing YouTube comedy, when people go off and leave platforms that they have a loyal fan base on, what can often happen, I think, is they leave the YouTube channel or wherever they came from dead. And that was like a big deal for us is that that's not going to be the case. We have like 360,000 people on YouTube who watch us pretty regularly, who will always watch whatever we put up. And if we were to just turn our back on them and just start making Netflix, that would just, it would just suck.
Mm.
So we made a real, what we did, and it's almost killed us, is alongside all of the press for this show and the podcasting and everything else we're doing, we made an original web series that's being released alongside the Netflix series. So we've got, the series is kind of like inspired by shows like Nathan For You and this show actually from Canada called Nirvana, the band, the show, and other things like that, where it's kind of this improv-y narrative. But the whole premise of this little web series we made is that it's us trying to promote the Netflix show, and that's where the Domino's deal came from.
Yeah.
Mark and I both got the Netflix logo tattooed on our ass because we were trying to get promotion like Jackass.
We got inked.
That was amazing. I loved it.
And the one that just came out last night is we're not making enough money, so we bootlegged DVDs of the show and sold them out the front of our office.
How excited were you to get, you know, Australian musical legends on board?
Yeah, do you like King Gizzard?
I've always heard of them. I've got a few mates out that way, so I've not heard that much of them, but I've always heard, yeah. So that was
they're
that,
just these like
that popped up. I was like, yes, just, this is amazing.
Everyone admires them because there's huge amount of them. There's six now, but I think there used to be 415. And they release like six albums a year sometimes, and they do their genre bending and they do so many different things, and they're really, really brilliant. But I went to high school with one of them, so I was like, hey, can you please come be in?
Broden's high school has bred some incredible fucking Australian artists.
Yeah, and it's not a public school. It's like what do you call it? They're like a government school. It's
state school.
Yeah, just a state school that just bred some cool people.
Yeah.
So
who's lean on in. your on your on your list, your school list?
Well, the three members of Auntie Donna came from that fucking school.
And then, King Gizzard. There was a group called Trump Disco, who is now Subhuman, who's this awesome electro superstar. Some really big hip-hop artists as well. Did Pez go to our school, Tom? Pez and some other Australian...
Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson.
The Queen of England?
Yeah, Elizabeth Windsor.
Cameron Diaz.
Snoop Dogg?
Snoop Dogg went
Snoop
there.
Scroobius Pip.
Yeah, Scroobius Pip went there. There's a lot of really famous people that went there.
It's just come to mind just because of thinking of Australian artists, but I just did my... I've not posted it because every artist is doing it, but I just got that Spotify...
Yeah.
Like, you know, everyone has their artist thing. My most listened to track was in Australia on September 7th between 3 and 4 a.m. Anyone was listening to my music, and I've not been able to figure out why...
That's amazing.
A boom in Australia September 7th between 3 and 4 a.m.
Is it 4 to 7... For Australian time?
I don't know.
That's so interesting. Do you know what area it was? Spotify has all of this data, and you know, you've just got to find the right person to prod, and they'll give you all the information. They'll tell you who it exactly was and what they were wearing at the time. And
I reckon. Here's my thinking. Work out what that time was.
Yeah.
See if you can get info from Shazam. I know Shazam has info, so maybe if people... And then also maybe like Triple J played it. Maybe someone played... Because Triple J is our big youth broadcaster. Yeah.
Or Triple J loved one of our songs back in the day. They hated everything else that we ever did, but this one song, they were like, this is the best. We got loads of royalties only from them. And maybe they've had a throwback.
Maybe they played it and then people Shazammed it and listened to it. Yeah. I that's my theory, but I don't know anything about this stuff. So
speaking of you all going to school together, was that when you kind of started doing Auntie Donna? I know it's a real, you know, hack journalist thing to be. How did you guys meet?
We met at university. Broden went to high school with Tom and Max. After high school, Broden and Tom went to acting school, and Max went off to become a filmmaker. And then Zach was also in that year level. I was in the year level below those guys. So when I came in and I was in first year, all these guys were in second year. But we ended up doing our university was like a regional one. You know, there's a couple of big acting schools in Australia, and ours was kind of always like fourth, fifth on the rank. It was right out in sort of the country, about an hour and a half or 2 hours out of Melbourne and shit. And I went in there as an older student, and these guys were above me, and our school was very encouraging, in terms of like, they constantly reminded us that you won't have a job when you get out of here. Like, there's no fucking work in Australia for actors, you know, and you have to be mindful of that. So they had a big push for autonomy. So often what we would do, what a lot of the students would do, was we would write our own plays and we would put them on in between our coursework and the other, you know, plays that we had to do. And some guy had written one, Zach was directing it, and he cast me, Broden, and Tom. Tom was the lead. He's our music man. Tom is our music boy. He does all our beats. He writes all our music. Tom was the lead, and he was incredible in it. Let me tell you that much right now. that was sort of the very, very early starting point for Donna. It was kind of like it was the first time I sort of stepped into these guys' world, because at our uni, you know, you're in your year level, and there's only like 25, maybe 30 people in your year. But you kind of stick to those people, and you don't really, you know, you see other people at parties and stuff, but it was very bizarre for me because I didn't find a lot of people that I like really connected with and really hit home with in my year level.
I was just going to go, you didn't connect with, and then like say someone random from his year level. But that was a joke. That would have been a joke for me, not for your listeners.
So I was like going through uni and like, oh, you know, I've made friends, but there was no one creatively that I felt like I clicked with until I met these guys and we ended up doing this show together. If Zach hadn't cast me in that play, I probably never would have been in Auntie Donna.
Yeah, it's funny because I think everyone has their own sort of, you know, if there was ever the story of Auntie Donna written down, it would almost, you'd almost have a chapter for each person and how they folded in or how they became a part of it, you know. But I often think about that, you know, when I look back at the path, whenever Mark tells that story, I remember that he auditioned for that play. It was just a little play that we performed once for 60 students. And he auditioned for that play. And my whole thing was just pushing the boundaries of taste with performance, I guess, in terms of like how big you can go. Like I just was always like, I think, you know, theater and like theatrical performance and comedy, people always underplay it. So I was just like, let's see how big we can go. Let's absolutely push, see how far we can push it. Which I think I've definitely brought into Auntie Donna.
I was going to say that definitely comes across on the Netflix show, because there is there's a going big but being impossibly comfortable with how big you're going. Do you know what I mean? There doesn't seem to be any kind of we might be going too over the top. It just feels you go big, but no one is aware that you're going big. If that makes sense, it's not Jim Carrey goes big and it's Jim Carrey going big. Do you know what I mean? Whereas it feels like there's huge, huge performances in there, but they're played kind of casually and no one is going, oh, man, that's...
Yeah, you know, it's very true. It's like, Bro talks about that a lot, about this idea that, and a lot of times when we get guest stars, they go, I'll play it small because you probably want that counterweight. And we're just like, no, the counterweight is the show you watch after us. You know, like this is a world. And that's something, you know, we tossed and turned about. But in the end, you come to it, it's like, no, this is the whole world. The whole world that Auntie Donna lives in is a lot. You know, it's too much. It's that big. But it's just, I was just going to say that when Mark tells that story, I remember, that was the first thing I'd ever directed, and I was still finding how to communicate to actors and stuff. And I remember I didn't convey to him how big I wanted it to be, and no one was really getting a big enough performance, but I didn't convey how big I wanted it to be. And he did an okay job. Well, he did a really good job, but there were no parts that were right for him. It was more of a script thing. There just wasn't a part that was right for him. And then I was auditioning another character the next day, and consistently people weren't acting big enough. And I was like, oh, Mark, you're here. Can you read across from people for me? Can you read opposite me? And I hadn't cast it yet. I hadn't told him that there wasn't really a part for him. And then I just said to him in his ear, I was like, look, no one's really going as big as I want them to go. So can you go more than you would go? Can you go like past the point that you should go? Can you just go, instead of 100%, can you go to 1,000% to pull them up? And it was this amazing moment where, based on that, which was not asking him to do what I thought I wanted him to do, it was to go further than that, Mark did a performance that was so big and so extreme and exactly what I wanted that I was like, oh, shit, I don't want 100%, I want 1,000%, that I ended up like going back to the writer and saying, we're rewriting this character as an Italian, like we're just going to make it work for him. And I just think, like, it's amazing to think, like, if he hadn't have been in the student lounge that day, this part of Auntie Donna, and thus Auntie Donna, probably wouldn't have happened. And there's so many little moments like that. It's just a funny little thought.
Yeah. I love that.
And Broden was there too.
So how was it to kind of go from to work your way into the comedy world? Because as you say, it's weird. A lot of comedy is so either America or UK centric, and we see it a lot with Ireland in the UK, that there's so much good stuff going on in Ireland, drama, comedy, everything, but for so long it was made in Ireland for Ireland, and it never seemed to make it anywhere else in the world. And I think Australia has had that over the years. Obviously we've then had a wave of drama and amazing actors with your Ben Mandelsons and just all sorts of others start to push things out, but with their own stuff, not with here I am turning up on something else, going, here's some Australian drama, here's some Australian. So how was that to kind of, after being told there's no jobs out there, there's nothing when you leave this, what are you going
to
do?
The first thing that I wanted to diverge to is Irish comedians and how Irish people are just will die for them and how they love them. You can talk to any Irish person and go, oh, I've met the Rubber Bandit boys, and they're like, you're joking. they love them so much. And yeah, and Foil Arms and Hog.
Last time I was in Ireland, I went out for drinks after the show I'd done with Blind Boy from Rubber Bandits. It's fucking amazing because he takes the bag off and he can just get on with his life.
Oh,
it's fucking perfect. He was guesting on my live podcast and he couldn't get into the venue because he was trying to quietly say who he is, but he didn't have the bag on his head. So he didn't want to no one knew he was the surprise guest. So he literally had to text me and go, Pip, mate, I can't get in. Can you come and get him to let me in?
Or can you bring me a Tesco bag, please? Yeah, exactly. Just one or the other.
Exactly.
I just love how diehard Irish fans are for Irish stuff. It's sick. So what we came, there's the Melbourne International Comedy Festival where we're from, and it's considered in the top three. There's Montreal and Edinburgh and Melbourne are the places that comedians go. And it's a huge reason for why we exist, because we left acting school and tried to do some interesting theatre and no one was having a bar of it. But then there was this big comedy festival and we're like, well, let's take our kind of weird stuff we do and make and say we're a comedy group, take this theatre company, say we're a comedy group and put it on. And we'd been around for a year or two trying to do interesting theatre and just family would come and no one else would come and it wasn't cutting through. And then we put on this show and we kind of just went, well, none of us are really great comedy writers. We don't have a history in that. That's not our, none of us went to, none of us went to sketch writing school.
Yeah.
And, so we just went, let's take all of our sort of theater training, our, Shakespeare skills and put them to us writing bad comedy. And hopefully we can trick people into think that the writing is okay by just doing big, bold, confident performances. And that was our kind of hope. And the first time we performed was an hour-length show was a real leap of faith. And we got nominated for an award in the first year, and that was enough for us to go, well, let's just go for it with this because people seem to like it. It's because we're in a community here where comedy is really, considered something good and important, people come out and see it, very similar to the way that Edinburgh Fringe is and Just for Laughs. Yeah, but what we saw a lot of the time, and particularly in Melbourne, there wasn't a history of sketch comedy the way there is in the UK or in America. So when we would go out and do comedy nights, it would be stand up, and then we'd come on and do a little play for people. And we just came from the exact opposite angle to the rest of the comedy scene in Melbourne. Often I think the challenge for comedians, and I don't know if it's the same with or poetry or anything, is where if you're a writer, half of your challenge is learning how to do that on stage confidently and not limiting yourself by fear. But we were coming from the other angle where we can stand on stage confidently for hours, but we didn't have the writing. So we came from the exact opposite direction.
Every other sketch show, I remember so clearly that every other sketch show that I saw that year or that was around were all stand-ups. They're all people who had individual stand-up careers or were trying to make stand-up careers happen. So the sketch always came from a very cerebral place. It was always very written. It was always about the writing. It was always about that idea. And us was always about just how stupid can we be? Can we make each other laugh with our bodies? Can we make each other laugh by yelling a certain way or doing something else? And it really was the attitude was we can't write, but we can sell a shit joke. We can sell anything. Give us anything and we'll be able to perform it and make it dumb and maybe that'll work and attended to.
There's almost a separation as well of the there's almost a separation of the mind and the body, or in that there's this really cerebral written sketch, and this is the same in the UK and the US. There's either this stuff that's really, really written and then said, it's about saying the joke, saying the words. Or there's physical comedy and it's clowning and it's like using your bodies to do comedy. And I think just because of almost our lack of exposure to the world of comedy and because of the certain set of skills we had, we didn't kind of think that way. It's just to us, it's you use everything in your arsenal. You use anything and everything you can grab at to get that laugh, whether it's physical, whether it's, performative, whether it's written. And I think that sort of informed us. It was almost a lack of training or a lack of knowledge that helped us.
It's such a great angle to have come in from, though, because the writing part you can go away and work on and get better at. But the confidence on stage, you can't really go away and work at. You have to be on stage doing that. So you have to go through bad performance after bad performance after bad performance to get to a comfortable level. And that can stop itself before it gets started as such. Because if you are nervous up there, the crowd projects that back at you. Whereas if you go up there confident, they're like, cool, this is a professional show. I'm here to enjoy it. Yeah. When do I laugh? Now? Okay, I'll laugh. You know what I mean? They're there on the cues. They're like, they're up for it.
Often the art of like creating anything is learning the art of simplicity and how simple something can be.
Yeah.
And if you can perform something, if you can get on stage or on screen and confidently do that idea simply, it's quite easy to see how simple something can be for someone to enjoy it. But if you're stuck away writing and getting into the minutiae of it, often you lose your connection to audience. But if you can boldly stand there and feel it, then it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's absolutely where ideas die for us, I think. Like whenever we've had good ideas that end up dying and not making it through, it's whenever we've been so fixated on getting the writing right. The writing has to be right. The writing has to be right. And then we try to perform that perfectly written thing, and it's never good. It's just never good.
but that again, it feels like that mindset will have come from drama school and stuff like that. Because like if you look at like the history of Russian theatre, their whole belief was you need an audience, otherwise the play isn't the play. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Even if you're practicing, there should be someone there. Otherwise, it's not the play. You need to have people there. Yeah. And that feels like that's kind of like, we need to get up there and bounce back and forth off the audience. Otherwise, we're just wanking away in a Word document. Definitely. Going, oh, isn't this wonderful? And then it doesn't actually translate.
Mm. I remember I had this, like, back when I used to have arguments with people about, like, art and theatre, because I was in my early 20s and I thought that was important.
And you had the energy.
And I had the energy, rather than just being like, all right, whatever. I remember I had this argument with a guy who, he was trained in America. I've got to be careful not to, like, he was trained in America and he was trained in that sort of film technique of finding your truth. It was all about finding your truth. And I remember I had an argument with him because he was talking about whether an audience could hear all the words. Like, because I think we were talking about a show where I couldn't hear the actor. And he was like, I don't think if there's someone in the back row can hear all the words, that's the most important thing. The most important thing is finding the truth. And I remember I just said to him, I'm like, what's more true than the fact that there's a paying audience member sitting in that room that needs to hear the words you're saying? Like, that's 100%. The truth.
Yeah.
Everything you're talking about as truth is a lie. The truth is you're in a room pretending to be someone and someone in the back of that room needs to hear you. Yeah. And I think that's something people forget. They forget that in comedy. They forget that in music, that it's like, the truth is actually what you're doing in that moment, and that is performance, I guess.
Yeah, or completely, or it's forgetting that everything, that you should be doing something in the medium you're doing it in for a reason. So if you're performing in a theatre, then that is part of that. Otherwise, go and make a film. Because since I've moved into acting, I told you I'd mention it, I've had a lot of people ask if I'll do any theatre, and I'm not up for doing theatre at the moment because I'm trying to learn screen acting. And I think it is different because, again, you can focus more on the finding your truth and letting the camera and the microphones do a lot of the work. Whereas in theatre, I completely agree. You need to be projecting to the whole room. The audience is part of it in that respect.
Can I ask you, as someone who's, you know, you're not really new to film, but you're like focusing on it now. Yeah. On the level of difficult things in your life, where do you put screen acting?
It's the highest and I adore it. Cause again, it's that excitement of, it's a tough one because I think I can't see a time where I'll ever be satisfied with my ability, if that makes sense, in acting. It feels like there's constant, every time I'm on a new set, I'm learning new stuff, and that excites me to keep going and going and going. With music and performance, you'd get to a point in a tour, for example, where you're like, yep, I've kind of got this nailed. They're going crazy at the right points every night. I'm doing this right. I'm kind of on top of this. Whereas in acting, it feels like there's always further and further to go. And
you got
more to learn.
Yeah, particularly if a director's not like, that was incredible, and often directors are unique people who are like, won't tell you you're doing a good job because they're worried about the lights or whatever. But we had this guru teacher at school who used to say, and it's like a big mantra for me when I do camera shit, which is where I am is what I need. So you're like, you're always doing the right thing. But it's a cool little phrase to sit with. Where I am is what I need.
Yeah, I love that.
So you're not worrying about, what do I have to do next? Or, you know, you just sit in that moment and do fine and know that what you're doing is probably enough.
Mm. Yeah, I completely agree. And it's one of the things that's been key to me is remembering that it's all meant to be enjoyable. Like, these are dream jobs that we're all doing. If it starts to get to the point where we're overthinking it and getting too obsessed with the art of it, it's like, obviously do your work on that, do your prep, but then when you get there, fucking relax and enjoy it a bit.
It's Bob Odenkirk from Mr. Show. He's also an actor, a comedian turned actor. I heard him on an interview recently say that when he was doing Mr. Show, which was his sketch show, he spent the whole time just pissed off and worried and stressed because, like, the writing, he wished he hadn't, but, like, yeah, it's like, it's hard as well when you're writing the content and then having to perform it, because you're also, the writer mind is going like, oh, do I have to correct this? Is this good enough? Do I have to compensate? Does actor Broden need to compensate for writer Broden's
work? You can't blame someone else.
Ago?
You can't be like, well, it's poorly written, or, well, they're not that. They're not giving me 1,000%, so it's just not. It's not right on my right. And you're like, oh, it's me.
It's something we've all kind of come to, like, where we'll say, you know, because we've got Sam who writes with us, and he just writes. You know, he's a writer, and he wants to be writing up until he's always thinking as a writer. And there's almost a line in the sand we have to draw in the development of anything, where it's like, from Monday, I'm not a writer anymore. I'm an actor. From Monday, I'm not going to have opinions. All I'm going to try and do is make what whoever that person was a week ago, who's not me anymore.
I have a cutoff point.
Whatever they gave me, that's what I'm going to try and make them work. And I might change words here and there, but as an actor who's an asshole, not respecting the writer, not as someone editing anymore.
And you can loosen your conscience on it as well, because it's yourself that you're disrespecting, really. You're not, you know, it's still shit, but it's like, fuck that guy. I know he wasn't in the right place for this particular line, rather than assuming it.
Yeah. But there just is a point where you have to kind of assume, you just have to, like, switch, I think. It's like, but I don't know. I love film acting. I love that you mentioned that, because it's like, I think with theater and with music, live stuff, it's almost live versus recorded, I imagine. It's the same with music, where with live, you're the master of that domain. Yes, you've been given the words. Yes, you've been directed. Yes, you've been, you know, you've got tech people. But really, it's your relationship with the audience. Whereas with film, I love, there's sort of a egalitarian kind of quality to it. Like, even the biggest stars in the world, in the end, they're still at the behest of the editor. They're still at the behest of the director. And the director has a producer above them. They have a writer above them. I was thinking about it the other day, and there's, even though there's hierarchies and there's people in charge, everyone's working for someone else on a film set. There's no boss, really. There's no one person making all the calls. And I think there's something really cool about that.
I completely agree. I think it's amazing. But, I mean, as time is flying by, one of the things I did definitely want to talk about was the kind of off-screen members of Auntie Donna, because it's more than just the three of you, and it's a key thing. And when I put on the first episode, I said, I've been racking my brain to think who did an Instagram post about it, but a comedian I follow did an Instagram post, and I thought, I'll give it a look. And within the first 10 minutes or so, I'd messaged like two mates about it, saying, you've got to watch this show. But when that outro music started, I think I messaged everyone I know saying, number one, you've got to watch this show, but number two, don't skip the outro music, because it's one of the best. It's fucking amazing. So
I'll put the guy sitting here, I'll put him, say thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much. That's a very big compliment. I appreciate it.
I love it. It was amazing. But like, how is that? That there's, you've, from what I know, you've always been, there's the three of you that are the on stage, but there is a director and music and all sorts of other stuff.
It's our secret weapon, and Tom can talk to this more. We've given him the mic. He has free reign now. God knows what's going to happen.
Oh, no. Our musician right here. He's sitting in the room with us because, you know, we got to zero cases in Victoria, so we're allowed in a room together. And here's Tom, if you wanted to answer that question, Tom. It's a little off.
Mr. Thomas Armstrong, right? Take it away.
Yes.
I know that because that name is on the Zoom link. That wasn't my actual research there. I thought I'd really big you up there and make you feel sorry.
That's
but go
cool.
ahead.
Yeah, I guess that's always been our secret weapon, and something that's always been really awesome about Auntie Donna is it's not just the three guys that you might see on stage or screen. There's this supporting cast of technical and people with different skill sets that are just as dedicated and put as much time in, and I think it really shows.
Yeah, we talk a lot about, you know, our mantra at the start was whatever's funniest. Because we came from theatre, we knew that there were other places and other platforms and other ways to deal with other things. And we saw in that, hey, if I want to explore these complex ideas, maybe an ensemble sketch comedy troupe isn't the best place to do that. What we can do is have fun and bring joy. But the other kind of more unofficial motto was like, get the best people. And yeah. it's something that boggles my mind. It comes down to poster design, really. Like, I always found it fascinating that people at acting school could spend 3 years learning how to act, you know that it takes 3 years. If you're not at acting school, it can take like a decade to learn how to act, but they would make their own posters for their fringe shows. But they reckon that, like, you know, I could take a nice photo, or they could take their own headshots. Yeah. And it just, we were just like, well, look, it took us 3 years to learn how to act. We're already bluffing with the writing. Let's get a good musician on. Let's get a good filmmaker on. Let's get people that know how to make posters to make our posters. And that's always sort of been a bit of a mantra of ours.
Mm-hmm.
Or one more thing with Tom then, how was it kind of, the pressure of stepping up to a Netflix show kind of thing? Because I think particularly, I think the performance side of entertainment, there's a level of imposter syndrome, but everyone I know on the production side, everyone has kind of done a lot themselves and taught themselves. And there's always that fear that as soon as I'm put in with the professionals, I'm going to be exposed. So did you feel excited or nervous or what?
Yeah, 100% nervous. And, like, I'd be lying if there wasn't times that I thought that I would not make it to this level, that I thought by the time we hit Netflix, maybe we would have to, you know, someone, an exec at Netflix would say, oh, no, we need to use this composer, you know, like, you three are great, but we need to use this person. I'd be lying if I didn't say that was a reality. But the truth of the matter is, every single person involved in the Netflix show, from these three guys to the producers to the execs at Netflix, pretty much let us do what we do best in the way that we've always done it. And there was never any suggestion that I wouldn't be able to deliver on mixing all the songs, recording all the songs, composing all the music, writing the theme songs, doing the outros. There was never a single suggestion that I wasn't capable of doing that. And the boys are super supportive of everything I do as well. Like, they put me in my place when I need to be put in my place, but overall they just give me free rein, which is amazing and really freeing, I would say.
I love it. It's beautiful. So, like, you spoke about the fan base kind of coming with you and it feeling like you're bringing everyone to this Netflix show. How was it to know that it's not just the three of you who've got this show? You're all jumping up. You're bringing everyone with you, essentially.
Oh, I think a lot of that is the reason we're, if you would call what we are, successful. Is because of that. Like, it's never been just like three performers trying to figure everything else out. You know, like, you know, because the reason we're performers in the group is because that's our particular strength, I would say.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Much like Tom's a musician because that's his strength. Sam's a writer because that's his strength. So that support, the fact that we always, stand-ups always talk to us about how jealous they are that we get to do comedy with our friends and that we get to go with our friends. And sometimes I've gone, oh, well, we actually sometimes get jealous that we just don't have that sort of complete autonomy where we can go off and every decision we make has to be made by a collective. But the more I've thought about it, the more we've gone on, it's like that's – without a doubt, one of the reasons why we are where we are today is because we've just always had support. We've always had, I've always had five other people who give a fuck about what I'm doing as much as I do, you know? And then you add the fans on top of that, and then there's a reason to keep going. You know, the fans give us, it's like, well, we might as well keep making stuff because there are people who give a shit. And once they stop giving a shit, then that's probably when we'll stop. You know, they all feed into each other. Like, I don't think any of us, and look, I might be wrong here, but maybe I just speak for myself, but I don't think any of us would have reached where we are on our own. We're where we are because we've all the kind of people that need that support and need that kind of kick up the ass and the accountability to make things happen. You know, we've been very lucky in that sense.
And also I think about, like, we've been doing it for 7 years and we've all had bad patches. You know, we've all had, you know, periods. As you do in a decade, you have those periods of time where you're not your best and you're not your best mentally, physically, just as a performer, as an artist. And to be able to kind of sit back, go, okay, like maybe the next 6 months I'm not going to be – but other people are driving it. There's this almost like we're always driving. It's just someone else is taking the wheel. There's this sort of looping around. So the collective is 100%, is 100% why we're here.
Yeah. The reason I was drawn to working with these guys, not just because I found them all really funny. And again, like how I said, there was no one in my year level who I really connected with. And the thing that I never connected with people in my year level was there was no one else who was, I thought, willing to just like work as hard as me, who just wanted to just like throw themselves in 100% and sacrifice everything else. Who cares about money? Who cares about where my money's coming from? If I have to work two other jobs, whatever. There was no one else like that, and I found that in these dudes, and that was really special. That was the thing that I think that connected us all more than anything else.
I love that. Well, I mean, with that connection in mind, then, and the group mentality, Mark, why have you got a fancy IMDb photo, and Broden and Zachary haven't?
Because I pay for
like,
it.
They're just outlines. It's like, what's going on here? This is
like an internal dilemma about it. I've got an internal dilemma about it because I'm like, acting school, everyone, you leave acting school, everyone just wants to fucking fleece you for all you're worth.
Yeah.
Like the first people that come to speak to you are the union and they're like, you got to give us $400 a year. And then there's someone after that and someone after that. And it's an industry where everyone's below poor and there's no work for anyone. And this, this career that we've forged for ourselves has just been about going like, we fuck auditions, fuck this. We're just going to make our own fucking road in front of us and make our way to wherever we're going. And anytime anyone's like, there's a paywall for this thing, I'm like, fuck you. I don't need it. Like, like, fuck you. Like, that's my, like, I'd so like, it would be nice to have a photo there, but part of me is just like, you can go fuck yourself. Like, I'm fucking, people watch my Netflix show and then they'll fucking use me for something. I'm like, go fuck yourself. I'm battling with that.
I literally did it because like, I got sick of fucking updating my CV. So now I'll just send people that. It's like, fucking just look at that. And it's like, and I've only been in a position this year where I felt like I could afford it because it's fucking expensive. So that's literally why I have it. Cause like a couple months ago, like before the TV show, I didn't even click to the fact that the TV show would come out and then this would be a thing because it's come up a few times. I was like, oh, I need to send my CV to people, so I'll just pay for this and send them that instead because it's easier.
The thing I want to do in my head is just put up pay for it, but just put Brad Pitt as my photo, like, and see if they stop me. Like, just fuck them all.
Well, I mean, speaking of blazing your own trail, Netflix seem really good at kind of, or TV is going this way a bit more at the moment of just finding voices that they believe in and letting them get on with it. I know it wasn't on Netflix, but I think Atlanta is a prime example where they clearly just went, Donald Glover is fucking great. Let's let him do what he's doing. Because again, on paper, a lot of Atlanta isn't going to be this big sell. It's like not much happens, but it's amazing.
That was our experience.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing I will say really, really unequivocally without pointing fingers, because I don't like to point fingers, but people often say, oh, it's because they have $8 billion. It's because they have so much money a year to spend on content, which is partially true. You know, you're spending $100 million. Like, if you're spending $15 million an episode on The Crown, you're not stressing too much about the little comedy show down the hall.
Yeah.
That's partially true. But something I will say to Netflix's credit that I think other networks could really take from them is the notion that if you've got five shows on your slate, and I think production companies could take this. I think anyone, if you've got five shows on your slate, or you've got three shows, or you've got 100 shows, stop treating each show as the thing you have to get perfect. You've got a slate. It's kind of a gamble. And I think you see so often you see people taking something and pushing it and just like polishing it until it's a three star. It's down to a three star rather than just like, I've got five things. I'm going to get five good, talented people to have a crack at something for five stars. And if I end up with 4 1 star shows and one like ripper, that's better than five mediocre things. Mm. And I think that's what Netflix does really well. They'll risk bad in the pursuit of brilliant. Which I think is so much better than shooting for good and getting good. You know, I think that's a real testament, and I think that's something I think a lot about. You know, it's good of them. It helps that they have so much money. But
there's nothing bad on Netflix.
Yeah, that's
there's nothing bad on Netflix, and everything is five stars. So that's what's interesting about that is that they get it every time. They get it right every time.
But you're completely right. I think there's so much that execs and whatever forget what drew them to the people that they've signed, or to the show that they've signed, or to the script that they've signed, and do start to then panic and break everything down and polish. And yeah, that can take all of the soul out of things. And I said that didn't come across with your show at all. It felt like, oh, no one's touched this. They've literally just said, you go ahead. Yeah, and we're going to make it.
It's all a timing thing. Like, for a long time, it was looking like we'd never get the chance to make a TV show because TV was dying, and then something else happened and we were able to make it in this form. But you hear the story about, like, Monty Python in the mid-60s going into BBC and them having literally prepared nothing and saying, like, oh, we're making it, and the executive going, is there music? And like, oh, we don't know. And like, do you have guest stars? Don't know. Are you going to shoot it on film? Oh, I haven't really thought about it. And him being like, that's, how dare you? I'll give you 10 episodes. Now get out. Like that's just a window in time where that person had no, there was no accountability at the BBC, and that was able to happen. But obviously brilliance happened. But just, I think, history, you've got to come around at the right time, or you've got to wait for that window to open up as well. But our experience of this literally was they went, make your show, and we went, no worries, and like made our show.
Yeah, there was so amazing. Much luck. Like, luck is hard work and timing, but fuck me, timing came in so hard into this, because it was like, I think we worked it out, whereas like if we stepped into Netflix's door like a few months beforehand or a few months after from when we did, the show wouldn't have happened, because a few months before they weren't looking for sketch. Then they started a sketch department, right? And a few months after we pitched, they'd already figured out their slate for their sketch department. And we just happened to walk in their door when they were looking for sketch. We were an established sketch group that already had a fan base. And to our credit, the idea was really well thought out and our pitch was very, very strong. So it just... And it wasn't like this for every network. Some networks didn't even want to talk to us because they were like, we're not looking for sketch. And that could have been Netflix. Yeah. But it was the timing of it was, we got so fucking lucky, man.
And I
love the
idea
of it feels like in the morning someone has been told, I'll find some sketch. And then they get an email off you in the evening like, I can go home early. I'm done.
Yeah, here it is.
Found them. Like, they've literally just started searching on Google, like, oh, that's my job done, I'll clock off, I'm going to go and watch this.
That's the BBC of the 1960s.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But I think as well there's definitely an element where, like, there are times where we were just desperate to get something or certain things, you know. We don't have, like, a shining record, you know, of our own, you know, work, you know, personally I can say that. But there's one thing I am proud of is I remember there was like a point we did the Just for Laughs Festival, and we did various meetings. And at that time, it was, I think, just after Trump got in, they were like, you got to do political. You, genuinely, there was these meetings where it's like, you've got to do political. Political is the thing to do. And we were just like, ah, I don't think that overt political figures talking about contemporary, we're more like timeless than that. And we're more talking about like the minutiae of every day. That's kind of our thing. I don't think we said that. We were more just like, oh, we'll think about it. But this idea of there was a point where it was like, if you want to do comedy, if you want to show, you have to do it this way. And I'm quite proud of the fact that we just sort of were like, oh, that's not really what we do. We could have shifted, and you see people that shift to the taste of the times. But it's like, I think there's a real, like, I look back at that, and it's something I would say to young people, like, just do what you do, do it for you, do it for your audience. And
yeah,
hopefully tastes will align at some point. If you keep traveling and, you know, fashions keep traveling, hopefully at some point it'll kind of hit. And if it doesn't, then better that you had some integrity along the way than doing something bad. I don't know. I
completely agree. Are a lot of your influences in that area then? Because, I mean, you mentioned earlier Nathan For You, and I think I'm on about my fourth rewatch of every episode of that. While I'm in kind of quarantine and lockdown and all this kind of thing. And it, for some reason, in the UK, it seems to be fairly unknown, but it's just flawless. So
it's one of those, it's a divider.
Yeah. It's again, it's exactly as you said there. It's someone who's gone, here's what I'm doing. Like, it's not like anything else. It's not like, oh, this is a version of this. It's like, no, he's doing his own weird little thing. And yeah,
it's funny wonderful. how humans are so desperate for something new as well. Like it, like we in every we have to have new things. We have to find new movements.
Yeah.
It seems to be ingrained, particularly I think in young people. Like you see it in music movements, and they must have a new thing. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
It's also really interesting as well. Like I remember, it's something that we've always tackled with, but I remember when we first started, like Flight of the Conchords was like the thing. I love Flight of the Conchords. That particularly season one of that HBO show, but both seasons is just such a pure diamond of a comedy show.
You see, I wasn't into them until season two, but purely for personal reasons, because their album came out the same week as my first ever album that was in shops, and they beat us on the charts by one space. And I'm like, it's not even a real band. It's not even a real thing. We're making art. And I was just such because again, I didn't expect to have a career. And yeah, after that, I was like, no, yeah, they are fucking genius. And yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. They are great. And it's funny. You start to realize everyone's on their own path as well as you get older.
Yeah.
I remember they were so in fashion and so it meant that what everyone was doing was the thing to do was be laid back. The thing to do was like this effortless sort of, and it was also Mighty Boosh as well. Just you'd come on stage and you were too cool and you kind of were above it or like removed from it, and the audience came to you. And I remember just being like, oh, that's what's good. That's what's cool. That's the stuff I'm watching. But I just don't think like, I can do that, you know, like bro can do it, Mark can do it to an extent, but I was just like, I just don't think I can do that.
Yeah.
And then it was just like, well, I'll just do what I know how to do. And then you stick around long enough, things change, fashions flip, you know,
it's just an interesting. The Vogue. Yeah.
Totally. It's mad, isn't it? Cause you realize that was across the board. Cause in music, you had like the Strokes and all sorts of these bands who were all exactly that kind of, I guess I'll play this song. Oh, I guess it's cool that you enjoyed it.
I still love watching the Strokes live now. They just did SNL and they just, they've never looked like they've ever given a shit or that any of them are enjoying what they're doing. I love the Strokes so much, but just still to this day, it's just always like, fuck, can I get the fuck off stage, please? That was always painted on their faces.
Yeah. I love that. Well, I mean, one thing, again, not to get into full PR for your show mode, but...
Oh, please do.
As I said, it blew me away from start to finish. But there were the cameos. Like, there were people I expected, or not expected, but I was delighted to see, but they're in the comedy world. Your Christian Charles, Ed Helms, Jessica Nappi, even Weirdo Yankovic because of the music crossovers. But I didn't expect fucking Homelander to rock up.
Yeah, man.
We had this journey with the show.
I literally paused and I was like, "That is, I need to look this up. That is Homelander, isn't it?" I was like, "Yeah, it fucking is Homelander. It's fucking Homelander."
Yeah, we
mind blown.
We asked a lot of people to be in the show, and no one knew who we were, so they just said, "Nah, I'd rather not." And we were getting to the point, we were getting closer and closer to the shoot, and we needed like people in it, and we didn't know anyone in America, And Sam was like, I think Homelander follows us. And he's the only one who'd watched The Boys at that time. And we're like, I don't even know what that is. He's like, yeah, I'm pretty sure Homelander's a fan.
Yeah, he's like Superman. He's in a show and he's like Superman.
Like, all right, that'll do. And then we just DM'd him. He's like, I'd fucking love to come down and do it. And then he was a lovely guy. And then like, then I went, after we wrapped, I watched it. And I was like, oh, my God. And then Mark watched it.
I watched it. I was just like, fuck me. Like, because I was like, this is going to come out and people are going to be like, you killed Homelander. And like, that hadn't hit me until I then watched like all of, like season two came out and then I just sat down and watched all of it. And I was like, this is going to be a thing. People are going to fucking talk to us about this. And they did. As soon as it came out, people were like, how'd you fucking kill Homelander?
I think the funniest layer of that as well was we were like, oh, he probably, because he's from New Zealand and we've got, you know, New Zealand, Australia, like he's probably a fan because he's from New Zealand. And then he came to set and we're like, so how did you find out about us? So was it friends in New Zealand? And he was like, no, it was Jack Quaid. He got all of the people on The Boys into it. And he's like, apparently on set, they would just quote one of our sketches, Pud, which is about Christmas pudding. It was like everyone on set while we were shooting season two of The Boys was just quoting Pud. And it was Jack Quaid that did it. And we're like, we got to get all the cast of The Boys onto our show.
That is now our goal, is that if we get three, four, however many seasons, we got to keep pushing for seasons until everyone that's ever been in The Boys has been in our show. That is our number one goal in life.
Well, once we get The Boys, all of The Boys, we're going to move. Maybe we'll see if Phoebe Waller-Bridge is open. And then eventually we want all of Amazon Prime to appear on our low-budget Netflix show.
It's the Marvel DC crossover that I never got as a kid.
Absolutely.
They're turning up. They're popping up everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, it's good to meet him in person as well because I'm like, he's not that strong and he's not that tall. I could take him. So if you're listening, Tony Starr, I could bash you.
Yeah, we think we could. All three of us versus him, he wouldn't stand a fucking chance.
He's just an actor. We could take him. He's strong, but it's like it's gym strong. It's not Homelander strong. No.
Calling out Henry Cavill as well. I reckon I could bash him too.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll argue with you on that because by chance, I mentioned this weirdly last week for the first time on a podcast, but I was at a mate's party at the beginning of this year and Henry Cavill was there and I had a quick chat with him and I've never seen a human that's so perfect. His face is perfect. Like he was wearing a shirt that was clearly several sizes too small and he should definitely have been wearing it because it was amazing. But he was one of them that I thought, this man in front of me is more impressive to me than Superman is.
Stepping
away from that, I'm more impressed with Henry Cavill than I am with the comic book character of Superman.
I've always been curious. The people like that, I've never seen an actor like one of those actors in person. I've never seen the Hemsworths in person or any of that. Is his chest and his arms like silly big in person?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Is it like just silly how big he is in person?
Yeah, it really was. Genuinely it was. And I was just the most awkward. I was DJing at this party, so I was a bit drunk anyway. And I was just genuinely just like trying not to just keep getting lost in just looking at, because again, you're meeting a guy for the first time and you're looking at his arms and you're looking at his shoulders a bit and you're looking at his chest a bit. And it's the creepiest shit in the world for him. And I'm just going, yeah, man, I agree. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. Just staring.
That's how people, I've heard people say that about me when they meet me as well. That's really interesting. Henry Cavill and I get that sort of response from people. That's just interesting.
It's so tough. Well,
I do. It's true.
Well, I mean, I've got one question that I promised my friend and tattoo artist, Mr. Heggie. I think he got into you guys. He guests in Australia a lot.
What's his name? And,
Mr. Heggie. Love his stuff. He's on Instagram. He's fucking amazing.
Okay, cool.
He did a tattoo on my leg that it's listed as, it says unicorn underneath, but it's a rhinoceros.
Oh, great.
But the rhinoceros is a unicorn. It's got a horn. Yeah. They're really rare. It's a unicorn, but yeah, he's amazing. You'll enjoy his stuff. But here's one question when I mentioned having you guys on was, why did you have to go to America for 6 months to film it when you could probably have filmed it in your backyard?
You know,
so it's not the most respectful of questions, but
no, but I can answer.
What's the kind of truth behind it?
American TV show. Is like Australia, for whatever reason, just found us too weird. We never really got the chance to make the show in Australia. They were like, we have this thing in Australia called cultural cringe, where if you go overseas and you make good, then you're good. Like the big one is like the Sydney Harbour. The Opera House, our big icon in Australia, is designed by a overseas artist, and because we don't make good stuff here. Anyway, we went overseas and we made it in America, and America, like Ed Helms and his production company, were like, "Yeah, let's just make it here." And the short story is, America wanted to make a show with us more than Australia did. Is the truth of it, it was a cool experience, to be honest. Like, it's a bunch of weirdos from Melbourne. They flew us all over. Gave us houses to live in and cool cars to drive around in, and like
so
we
great.
Just like ate American food and went to Disneyland and made a TV show that was ours. Like,
and I'll say as well, we made two pilots in Australia. We've made all of our YouTube content in Australia, and we were in the car park of the Netflix studio after the pitch. Talking to producers and stuff after the pitch, saying, you know, we would love to film this. Even then, when it was an American show that we pitched in America, we were like, we'd love to film this in Australia if we can. You know, there are options. So it's not for want of trying. You know, it really isn't. We wanted to make stuff in Australia, and we have made stuff in Australia, and
of course.
We even tried to make this in Australia if we could have. So we tried, and we hope to make much more stuff in Australia. We've got such great crew here and so many great creative people here that 100% we want to make more in Australia, and we hope this is the gateway and the window to some American money to make Australian content.
It translates well. The beauty of making it in America is you could go, oh, who's local? Oh, Homelander. This guy, that guy. It's so much easier to go, oh, who can we get in at the last minute? Oh, these huge stars. Fantastic.
It's very true. Weird Al Yankovic emailed us like halfway through the shoot, I think, and said that he wanted to be in it. And that doesn't really traditionally happen in Melbourne.
That's fucking amazing. So I guess the wrap-up question is what's ahead? Because it's a mad one, because getting a show on Netflix is such a fucking end goal kind of moment. So that must be a hard thing to go, all right, and now we have to continue on with this. This is something that we have to continue our lives. We don't just end here. Like, you have a lot of things, particularly in these kind of entertainment industries, that you have as your goals, and then you do them, and then you're like, oh,
what now?
It's happened now. I was striving towards that, and now it's happened. What next?
Well, we've always been a very forward-thinking group in the sense that we care about calendars a lot. We always know what we're doing 6-12 months ahead of whatever we're doing now. Yeah. And we always plan. We're always like, okay, if this doesn't work out, we've got this thing that might happen, say it's a Netflix show or say it's a season two or whatever. We always go, if that happens, great, we'll do that. If it doesn't happen, let's make sure we know exactly what we're doing for 12 months. So then we feel disappointment for a day. And then we turn up to work the next day and we keep doing what we've already got planned. And then if we need to change our plans, because it does happen, great. We've always been that group. With COVID and shit, this is the first time ever where we haven't really been able to plan because we don't know what the fuck next year holds. But in terms of the way you talk about it as an end goal is so true. Like from day one of this group, like as soon as we clicked in and we went, let's do Auntie Donna. The goal was we want that half hour TV show. We love that idea. We grew up on that format. Like, internet's where we're finding sort of success and popularity, and it's where we're building a fan base. But TV is so core to us as creators and what we love. It's what we want. And so now we're here. And I think the conversations for us have always been, well, what that will allow us to do, hopefully, it will allow us to do everything else that we're doing, but possibly on a bigger scale. So we like Broden was saying earlier, like, you know, keeping the YouTube going is really important to us. Being a big presence on all our social medias is really important to us. Touring our live shows and writing brand new material, building a brand new hour for people to see, is still really fucking important to us. And we're going to keep doing those things, but we might be doing them in slightly bigger venues, and we might be doing them to more people. And that's about it. We're at the moment, we're just looking at next year and what touring is like around our country, and we're planning for that. And that's kind of where we're at. But we're never gonna, we've never put all our eggs in one basket. And like the TV thing is a perfect example of like, that's great. And if we get more of it, fucking awesome. But there's a lot of other things that we do and a lot of other things that we want to keep doing.
It's, you know, we called our first pilot Auntie Donna, but the name of the show was Auntie Donna. And, this show isn't called Auntie Donna. It's called Auntie Donna's Big Old House of Fun. And that was a really like important thing for me, at least, but I think for the group, because it was like, this is not the end goal. This is not now all of what we are. I think a lot of the time people get TV and they're like, this is us, you know, and we really wanted it to be, it's one part of a tapestry. It's one part of a whole, you know, we hope at the end, if this ever ends, people won't look at any one thing as the thing. It's kind of a whole work. And it's when I, it's a comedy show. I don't want to get too serious about it, but when I think about it in terms of the idea that I've got as a theater maker, as a creative, I've been able to work on one project that transcends and exists on so many different platforms and in so many different ways. That's really, really cool to me. You know, I've played this character for so long and I've played within this concept, and the idea of a piece of art or entertainment that exists outside of any form is really interesting to me and really exciting. And I think, you know, if you think too linearly or if you think just up, you know, yeah, we've hit the TV show. Sure, there's movies. I'd love to make an Auntie Donna movie one day. But I think as well, I like to think linearly as well. You know, we made an album when we didn't have to, you know, there's books, there's comics, there's anything, you know, I like the idea that it's not linear. It's kind of broader and weirder and a bit more vibey than that.
I completely agree. Cause again, it's also the exact time for that kind of thinking because of the reach of the internet and YouTube and whatever else. There's so many variations of things that you could do or could come up with that it's like, right, the limits aren't there. And the beauty of what you guys have done is you've got this success off the back of doing it your way. It's not like you've gone out and done it and then gone, well, now we've been signed and someone else has gone, here you go. Here's the magic powder. You've got it in spite of not being necessarily, as you said, what they were looking for at the time or this or that. So that does give you that scope to go, right, well, we can do what the fuck we want. Essentially, creatively, we can go in the direction that we want to go in and see what happens and see where it lands. I love it. And it's kind of beautiful that we got 70 minutes into a conversation before we even mentioned the nationwide pandemic, which is incredibly rare. So I'll end by kind of saying, how is it all for you guys? Are you all okay? Is everyone holding up well?
Yeah, we're fine. We're just out of like 150-day hardcore lockdown. Melbourne, Australia has just started opening up. You know, like in places like Sydney and Brisbane, people aren't wearing masks anymore. Restaurants are at full capacity. Everyone's fine. We're just starting to get there and borders are starting to go down. So Australia's starting to get back to normal, which is fucking sick. But Melburnians have done it the hardest out of everyone. Yeah. So, like it was sick that we were able to keep our business running and we're able to keep doing shit during that lockdown and went a bit fucking crazy and needed to see my therapist a little bit more than I normally do. But, but we got through it, baby, and we're lights at the end of the tunnel now. Thankfully, we're pretty lucky over here. We're pretty lucky that people, Australians have a thing where I think they don't think they like to be told what to do, or they have an attitude of like, I don't want to be told what to do, but then they're told what to do and they're like, yeah, all right.
they'll whinge.
Yeah,
but they'll do it.
They'll do it.
Like teenagers.
Yeah, Americans are fuck you, and Australians are fuck you. But all right, like that's kind of the difference I've found.
I love it. Well, thank you very much for your time, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure, and it's flown
thank
by.
Thank you, Pip. It was beautiful talking to you.
Yeah, really appreciate it, man. Particularly just someone who watched the show and then wanted to support it. We really appreciate
That's
it.
That's huge. That's huge.
Yeah. No, it was great. As said, I binged the whole lot in 24 hours. I put one on thinking, I've heard this is going to be interesting. I couldn't even say I've necessarily heard it's good. I've heard it's going to be interesting. And yeah, it blew me away. It's a good work on what you've done. And yeah, I look forward to a season two or a fucking fruit range or whatever other weird direction you choose to go in the end.
Hey, man, whatever the
Who
fuck
knows?
We do.
Who knows?
A vineyard.
A vineyard, yeah. A Domino's store.
Perfect.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. I hope you enjoyed that. Absolute dudes, right? I love talking to them. I love their outlook. Little bit of behind the curtain stuff. I'd made a note of who was who, because I don't normally have multiple people on at once, but I love these guys. I thought they were amazing, but I am still new to them. I binged the whole thing in one day. I made a note of who was who on my phone, and somehow I noted it wrong anyway. So I noted literally what I wrote down. Mark, open bracket, beard, close bracket. I got that one right. Broden, open bracket, long hair, close bracket. Wrong. Zachary, open bracket, ginger, close bracket. Wrong. I got those two round the wrong way. And about halfway through, I was like, hang on. The names I'm thinking aren't matching the people. So yeah, I just want to tell you that I can't remember if I revealed myself at any point on my error. I think I covered it up. I may well have not. But yeah, that was some good fun. As said, go and watch their show on Netflix. As you will have heard from Zachary talking about wanting to go to 1,000%, it doesn't let up. It goes hard from the start, but it's a wonderful ride. And as you will have heard from the chat, I adored it. I was excited to talk to the guys. I'm a new fan, but an enthusiastic fan. So yeah, thank you for tuning in. I'll be back next week. Obviously, head over to patreon.com/scroobiuspip if you want some videos of some recent chats. There'll be loads up by now. We'll almost be at the full 12, right? Almost. And head to speechdevelopmentrecords.com for all that good shit. My name is Scroobius Pip. Come and holler on socials. I've not mentioned that in ages. Come and holler on socials. I fucked off Facebook. It's still there, but I'm not on it. I don't go on it anymore. I'm not telling you that Facebook is still there. You would have heard if that had gone down. But my Facebook is still there. But now it's just, I just use Instagram and Twitter, but the Instagram posts go automatically to Facebook. I don't know why I need to tell you this, but Facebook is now unmanned. But Instagram is manned like a motherfucker, manned too much, if I'm honest, overmanned. It's a weird year, so my usage is through the roof. And Twitter as well is manned. I try and ease up on that because I think it's a depressing place. But, you know, I check on the regs and I say things like on the regs. So that's who I be. I will see you all next week for another episode of the Distraction Pieces podcast. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.